Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Tuesday, September 19th, 2023. I'm Lou DeVizio. Sorry for uploading the pod a little late this week, everyone. I was out on a field shoot in Santa Fe yesterday with correspondent Antonia Gonzalez for a piece that we're pretty excited about. She'll feature a nonprofit called Free Flow New Mexico that's partnering with public libraries in the capital city, where they've set up free, self-serve kiosks where anyone can pick up period hygiene products 24 hours a day. There's a lot more to the program, but I don't want to give it all away just yet. That story will air on a future episode of New Mexico in Focus. For now, if you're interested in the program, I've included a link in the description of this podcast episode. Now, let's get into the headlines. The family of a man shot and killed by Farmington police, who were supposed to be responding to a different address in April, is now suing the city and three officers. Police were initially called to a report of domestic violence, but arrived at the wrong house, across the street. 52-year-old Robert Dotson and his wife were upstairs when they thought they heard a knock. According to the lawsuit, Dotson went downstairs with his handgun because it was so late. The lawsuit cites video from Dotson's doorbell cam showing the officers backing away as Dotson opened the door. Then the officers fired, shooting Dotson 12 times. His attorneys say he was blinded by the officers' flashlights when he opened the door. The lawsuit goes on to describe what followed. Dotson's wife came downstairs and found her husband lying in the doorway. She then fired outside, not knowing who had shot her husband. Police fired back, each of their 19 rounds missing the woman. Lawyers for the Dotson family say that after the shooting happened, Farmington police handcuffed Dotson's wife and her two teenage children and took them to the station for questioning without acknowledging the error. An attorney representing the officers says the mapping system in the lead officer's car placed the pin on Dotson's home instead of the house across the street where the domestic violence call had come from. Lawyers for the family are questioning the officer's reliance on technology and are calling for more training and oversight on the use of force within the Farmington Police Department. Updated COVID-19 vaccines are here and available at doctor's offices, pharmacies, and public health offices this week. State Health Director Miranda Durham says everyone 6 months and older should get vaccinated regardless of prior COVID-19 shots. While RSV and the flu haven't hit New Mexico hard, COVID-19 hospitalizations are rising. Cases are not at pandemic levels, but vaccine rates have recently dropped, sparking concerns among doctors. Most insurance plans cover the booster, but if you don't have medical insurance, the easiest way to get a vaccine is through the CDC's Bridge Access Program, which offers limited free access to the shot through the end of December 2024. Major pharmacies, including Walgreens and CVS, are participating in that program. The Vaccines for Children program also provides doses to children whose parents may not be able to afford them. You can find your nearest vaccine provider at vaccinenm.org. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has walked back a key piece of her 30-day public health order banning open and concealed firearms in public in Bernalillo County. The governor made the announcement late last week after days of political pushback and a temporary restraining order issued by a federal judge. Friday, the governor limited the firearm ban to public parks and playgrounds or any public area provided for children within Bernalillo County. Albuquerque Mayor Tim Keller quickly responded to the governor's revisions on Twitter saying, quote, "We banned guns from almost all city parks in 2020. It's being challenged in court," end quote. The revised order also prioritizes speedy drug and alcohol treatment placements within 24 hours for those seeking help. During Friday's news conference, the governor also announced that police will be arresting people for using illegal drugs in the state's largest city, another escalation of the law enforcement crackdown she rolled out with the original executive order week before last. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham's public health order on gun violence is still the hot-button story this week, even after she announced the changes that I just talked about last week. Those changes came days after a federal judge issued a temporary restraining order blocking the governor's attempt to ban the carrying of a gun in a public place in Bernalillo County for 30 days. So, just to recap quickly, the governor first issued that order Friday, September 8th, 2 days after what police called a road rage shooting in Albuquerque that killed an 11-year-old boy and severely injured a woman in her 20s outside Isotopes Park. Less than a week later, U.S. District Judge David Urias blocked part of the order, siding with gun owners who say their constitutional rights had been violated. But there is still plenty to talk about today. Right now on the podcast, executive producer Jeff Proctor speaks with a special roundtable about the governor's move. Joining Jeff are longtime civil rights and criminal defense attorney Frank Davis, former APD sergeant turned attorney Tom Grover, and Marisa DeMarco, a national editor for State's Newsroom. Keep in mind, this roundtable discussion was recorded after Judge Urias' temporary restraining order and before the governor revised her attempted firearm ban. Here's Jeff.
We're going to spend plenty of time on the governor's order and fallout from it, but we want to get quickly to the elephant in the room, the Second Amendment. Judge Urias has granted gun owners' request for a temporary restraining order, saying they have, quote, a substantial likelihood, unquote, of prevailing if the case proceeds. Frank, let's start with you. What does the judge's order mean?
The judge's order means that this order likely violates the Second Amendment and is unconstitutional. And I think that that's something that most everyone is going to agree upon. The Second Amendment is intended to protect the individual's right to self-defense. And we start with the presumption that if the conduct is covered by the text of amendment, which here we're talking about carrying in a public place, that the conduct is constitutional. And I think that pretty well does away with the most controversial portion of the governor's order.
Did it come as a surprise to anybody from your perspective that this went the way that it went?
It's shockingly to me. There are a good number of lawyers who were supportive of the governor's order, these are folks that I myself look up to, and I think that they're good lawyers, and they've been doing this a lot longer than me. But what the sentiment has been is that finally someone's doing something. But I don't think that anyone realistically believed that it would withstand any sort of constitutional scrutiny.
Tom, I'll kick this to you too. Obviously, the judge's order is granting a temporary restraining order. It's not a broad ruling in the case. It's pretty narrow. From your perspective, was the governor's order just a straight-up violation of the Second Amendment?
I think aspects of it clearly were. I mean, without a doubt. It put in place restrictions that have already been adjudicated by the U.S. Supreme Court. And, you know, I'm talking about the Bruin case, obviously, and that's in the setting of Manhattan, right? Well, here we are in the Southwest where, like it or not, guns are a part of the culture here and the history. And with what she did with her order was such overreach, it's not surprising with what happened.
Let's pull back a little bit here and talk about the problem the governor says she's trying to fix. We saw 120 homicides in this city last year. That's a record by a lot. Mayor Tim Keller says the numbers are leveling off a bit this year, but we are still way above national averages for violent crime. I think everyone who lives here would agree that the vibe in our city feels a little different than it used to 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago. And of course, the governor's order cites the shooting deaths of two young children. Tom, I want to go back to you. You're a former cop. What sits under the crime problem here, and do the governor's proposals present a viable solution from your perspective?
I think they're misguided at best, because what I see, and this is based off of having been a street cop for 8 years in bad sections of the city and now having been an attorney for almost 10 years, is that things are bad and things have gotten worse. And with the police sort of withdrawing back courtesy of the new mayor back in 2018 and DOJ reform, there's been really like a lack of guardrails. And, you know, it's like watching a soccer game when you've got weak officiating. It doesn't take too long for the kids start to really get out of control and people to get injured, because they realize they can take actions and there's no repercussions. And from my perspective, I mean, that's really what's going on. And there isn't anything in the order that suggests there's going to be any sort of, you know, reinforcement to the guardrails to put people in a position where they recognize that if I do something wrong, chances are I'm going to get stopped or have some contact with somebody who I don't want to have contact with, that being law enforcement.
But I'll jump in and say too that, you know, guns have been, and violence and gun violence have been a problem in Albuquerque and in New Mexico for a very long time. And we have actually seen overall, if you're pulling way back and looking at the scale, we've started to see declines in those things. And all throughout the pandemic, people were telling us that we were going to see more domestic violence, more substance use, that sort of thing, because of the impacts of isolation, and that would have effect on the city for years and years to come. And so I wonder if we're starting to see some of the impacts of that. Also, I will say about the hearing yesterday that what I was reading in Source New Mexico's reporting is that the judge seems to be giving the state the opportunity to produce the evidence that we're in an especially acute phase of public health emergency, right? And that that could potentially justify the order, is what the conversation in the courtroom seemed to be pointing at yesterday. Also, the judge was pointing out that the back and forth between the judge and the attorneys was around, you know, there was a public health order during the pandemic about gathering in public places. And this was because COVID, a deadly virus, could immediately be passed to one another from those gatherings. And the question is, does simply having guns in public places increase the likelihood of gun violence? That seems to be at the crux of the conversation in court.
For sure. And I want to stick with you for a minute, too, and talk about, based on your years of reporting here, too, could the governor's, all of this energy from the governor, have been better spent focusing on the things that you and I have both been reporting on for all of these years that sit under the crime, whether that's substance use disorder, poverty? There are a million factors that we all know. Do you feel like her energy could have been better spent to focus on some of those things instead of picking this big fight with the Second Amendment?
You know, what stuck out to me was that this was a public health order, but these are not necessarily what public health experts would recommend as solutions, right? So public health is about looking at the overall health, the big statistics. This is, it struck me as somewhat of a knee-jerk reaction that relies heavily on increased law enforcement, whether that's for guns or for other things. And so it's public health order in kind of name only in that way, right?
So the governor conceded at her news conference last week that she wasn't sure how this was going to play out in court. And now she's lost the first round. But almost from the beginning, she's hinted that her main goal is to kickstart a debate about gun violence.
But I'm doing it because I think that debate and getting into the session about what does need to work is appropriate. And if not me, then who is gonna initiate the debate?
If this order was meant to be a conversation starter or to spur the legislature to pass stricter gun laws, was a big executive order the best way to do that? I'll let anybody who wants to take a swing at this one to go for it, but has that message been overwhelmed by what most folks see as a massive government overreach? Frank.
The conversations have certainly been ignited, so I can't call it a failure in that regard.
Right, we're talking about it.
Right, and everyone is. You have people from Elon Musk calling for her removal from office, all the way to reporters across the country using words like tyranny, despot, you know, things like that. So the controversy has succeeded in igniting a discussion, and I think that all of us can agree that there is some sort of emergency going on with the way that we're losing lives to gun violence. How we go about dealing with that, I think, is where we're going to reach disagreement.
Does anybody think that we're going to settle into, eventually, the conversation that the governor wants here, which is about gun violence? Are we going to get past this initial shock and outrage and memes all over Twitter of her with a hammer and sickle sitting beneath her face?
I think she's animated a portion of the demographic out there that has been on the sidelines but now is actively opposed to her. I mean, I don't see a silver lining to what she's done, because she's alienated herself with people that weren't previously alienated from her. Sure, she might have consolidated some support upon people that already had a posture when it comes to gun control, but in terms of, you know, where things go in the long game, I don't see how this is a benefit, because the whole issue of crime has been pushed off to the side and the projection has been put upon her for, you know, dictatorial powers or tyrant or things like that. So I think it's sort of ambushed whatever benefit could have been brought from it or from her office.
I think the conversation has so largely focused on the Second Amendment, and that has subsumed kind of the conversation about gun violence. But the other thing that occurs to me is she had to have known that that was where this was going to go, at least in the early days. And so I don't know what is the next move in this conversation or what is what is really being angled at, right? This move kind of feeds into that far-right paranoid nightmare about dictatorial control and the government is coming for your guns, right? And so I just don't understand how it is that we won't end up stuck there in that conversation, as opposed to having the one that everybody's angling to have about gun death rates and gun violence in New Mexico.
I have to disagree just a little bit with Thomas and Marisa, because I think that there is a sigh of relief from some people that finally someone is doing something. We've seen mass shooting after mass shooting. We've seen killing after killing, violence throughout our state. And now it just feels like, okay, nothing has been done in each of those instances, whether or not that's accurate. But now the governor has done something. But I think she's created a responsibility and an onus for herself to keep this going. She can't just throw up her hands and say, oh, I tried and, you know, the court struck me down. She has to be more creative. She has to be more thoughtful. This order doesn't seem that thoughtful. And it doesn't seem like she put a lot of effort into crafting something that was going to be constitutional. But if she goes forward and she tries to come up with some solution that is creative and thoughtful and has some brain power behind it, we could see a change finally on this gun violence issue.
The thing is that we haven't seen that yet, and maybe this is a media coverage criticism, right? Which, you know, member of the media over here. But we've seen primarily from even members of her own party, from, you know, everybody has criticism of this move, largely based on the firestorm it ignited about the Second Amendment. I haven't seen in much coverage people who, even just everyday people, who might be like, well, thank goodness, you know, we needed something. And even if it only stood for, what was that, 5 days? Was it I don't know if it got through
a week.
Not quite a week, right?
Yeah.
You know, we needed something like that. I haven't seen that in the media coverage just yet. So I guess my comments are more focused on what we have seen, which is even members of her own party speaking against it. Very few people being willing to take a public stand that they're in support of this move,
sure,
right?
Like Miranda Viscoli, right? That was one name that immediately came to mind. But I want to rewind the tape just a little bit to last weekend. We all saw images of guys with beards and long guns protesting on the Old Town Plaza last weekend. Marisa, you were there. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell me, please, what that felt like. What was it like down there?
People were outraged. People were heavily armed. There was a notable lack of visible police presence. I covered, I think, all of or most of the protests in 2020, in which thousands of people were out speaking against gun violence, and they were unarmed, and there was heavy police presence, even at things like candlelight vigils and such. It was smaller, maybe a few hundred people, 300, something like that. But there was not people there, there was not state police officers there that were visible who were enforcing this order, right, which was already in effect. And we're seeing people with, you know, really heavy weaponry, like, and intentionally carrying it in a very visible and intentional way, right?
It sounded like things were pretty tense based on our conversation in advance of taping today.
Yeah, I mean, I think, even among the speakers, there was warnings, like, keep it cool, everybody, because that's a lot of firepower to have in one place. And what does it take for that to turn into something really bad and violent, right? Which was interesting, because that seems to be around speaking to what the governor's speaking to a little bit as well, which is, like, how many high-powered guns does it take in a small area for something to turn into violence, right? Mm. But there was a lot of speaking about, okay, we're here to be passionate, but cool, let's keep it cool, and there was not any violence. I don't know if the scenario would have been different had the police shown up and issued citations for being a violation of the order. Mm-hmm. You know, they're in Old Town under the gazebo, tourists are wandering around the perimeter, and they have, you know, like, massive guns, right? So it was an interesting scene, to say the least.
One more thing I want to get to, and Tom, I want to start with you on this one. The Second Amendment argument will continue to play out in the federal courts beyond the temporary restraining order that Judge Urdias granted earlier this week. But is there a bigger legal conversation here? Is there a case, potentially, that winds up in front of the state Supreme Court in which we finally get to sort out the limits of executive power?
Undoubtedly, I think it's headed that way. But I want to remark one thing about the protest on Sunday. a couple years ago, I represented a young African-American man that went to Civic Plaza, decked out in the same sort of paramilitary attire that those protesters were wearing on Sunday, with, you know, a 223, you know, AR variant rifle. And he wasn't out on the sidewalk adjacent to Civic Plaza for maybe 5 minutes before APD's emergency response team came down, made contact with him, and they pulled him aside. And then there was this big kerfuffle about whether or not he was going to be cited or not. APD did a social media post saying he had been detained and was going to be cited. You know, long story short, is the city ended up paying my client a fair amount of money for that.
Yeah, and we'll get to some of that in the second segment for sure. But let's talk about the executive power thing. Sorry to push you back on track.
No, I think it's headed that way if the Republicans certainly get their way. And I think with the type of counsel that were in court yesterday, there is a fair amount of broad spectrum interest in this issue that's not limited just to Democrats or Republicans, conservatives or liberals, about what it means when the chief executive takes an action that's in contravention to the Constitution, whether it's the state or federal. And, you know, we saw a lot of people upset about what the governor had done during the pandemic. And I think this is sort of an extension of that. And I think it's going to go back to the Supreme Court in one way or fashion. And we know how it played out the last time is before the Supreme Court, and they went 5-0 against her.
Frank, I want you to weigh in on this one too. Do we need an actual better definition for what constitutes a public emergency in this state? Do we need that spelled out?
I think it's on the way. I have a good word that the Republican Party is filing a case in state court this week that was going to seek to confine what these public emergencies, public health emergencies mean. Whether we need it or not is a different question. I mean, there's really been limited use, and it arose in the context of the pandemic, which of course was a worldwide, once in a lifetime sort of phenomenon, but now we have it rearing its head again. And that was my initial concern when the governor first used this emergency power was, we're going to see another emergency, right? That's sort of what happens when you give a politician these sort of powers. And so probably we could benefit from some sort of definition or some instruction from the court. So I think that is necessary.
We're not guessing. Hours after Judge Urdias blocked the gun carry ban portion of the governor's order, officials announced a beefed up state police presence in Albuquerque with no time limit. We'll get to that in a bit. It's clear the governor believes more law enforcement leads to reductions in crime. She's asked, begged to use her word, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland to send, quote, additional law enforcement to New Mexico to assist in curbing the escalating violence and drug and human trafficking activity that is ravaging our great state, close quote. An official at Maine Justice in Washington tells me that the department has been in regular contact with the Lujan Grisham administration over the past few months, and 19 additional agents have already been sent to Albuquerque this year, though it's not clear how they're assigned. The local U.S. Attorney's Office detailed several initiatives to combat gun violence that predate the governor's executive order. Tom, does increasing patrols with no clear instructions or even targeted operations make a difference in your experience?
I mean, it can in the short-term effect. The presence will deter folks in that area. The long-lasting effect, I think, is undetermined. And I think as we saw with Surge 1.0 and Surge 2.0, it was really unclear. Maybe those neighborhoods, while they had state police officers patrolling the area, observed or experienced an increased feeling of safety. Maybe not, but it takes more of a strategic effort rather than a simply tact plan or tactical effort to deter the type of crime that we're having. And part of the issue that sort of makes me lose my mind is that all we've been hearing from the Keller administration is that crime has been going down by their own data. So yes, we've had this spike in a homicide, and homicide's an entirely different pathogen, if you will, compared to the other types of crimes. And is having state police here going to suppress the incidences of homicide? I think that remains to be seen.
I want to kick this to you, Marisa, and your experience reporting on these issues. I know you've had a lot of conversations with folks in the International District, in the South Valley, and elsewhere. Do people, from your experience as a reporter, tend to feel safer when there are more cops in their neighborhoods?
The reporting that I did in 2019 during the first Metro surge was no. The neighborhood and the neighbors often felt like they were under siege. There's police patrols stacked five deep rolling down just neighborhood streets. And the thing is that even with the Metro surge, this is not the first such operation that seems to target the International District, which especially where I was speaking with people. You know, a lot of neighbors said they see repeat operations. They see sudden surges of APD or BURNCO sheriffs doing warrant sweeps or state police or federal operations. Like, it's pretty regular that one agency or another shows up and has a really big presence in that collection of neighborhoods. And it's worth saying too that that is one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the state. It has, it's often a lower income neighborhood. The first Metro surge, after they initially targeted especially the International District, fanned out some to Westgate, which is also a largely Hispanic neighborhood, often with families with lower incomes. And so you're seeing that part of what happens with all these orders or operations or even just the laws that are in place is that certain communities feel like they're being targeted, especially by those laws. And so the result is not necessarily a overall feeling of increased safety. But I would say that, you know, we saw sometimes with these surges or these operations that maybe crime went down a little bit during the operation, but then it pops right back up. And so if we're looking at this as a public health issue, as a pervasive public health issue over time, you're not seeing the kind of gains that you might want to see. And in fact, as we know, when people enter the criminal legal system, it often leads to recidivism, to more kinds of crime. So there is a potential that when you just go out, bust a lot of chops, first Metro surge had 15,000 traffic stops, almost, I think it's like 14.6, right? That people end up going through the criminal legal system and coming out the other side, having lost their jobs, having maybe had familial relationships destroyed, having a lot of like community supports ruined, and that can lead to more crime. Mm-hmm. So it's unclear if, even if this temporarily dampens a crime rate potentially, not always also, if it doesn't in fact lead to more on the other side, right?
Yeah, let's get to some of that, right? We have seen this movie before. Federal law enforcement intervention in the name of reducing crime in Albuquerque has produced disastrous results in the past. There were massive racial disparities among the overwhelmingly low-level drug offenders arrested by the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives in 2016. I spent 3 years writing about that. There was Donald Trump's Operation Legend. And then, as we've just been talking about, there was the so-called Metro Surge. None of these, in the long term, has touched the crime rate. During our news conference last week, the governor had this to say about this kind of approach.
Unlike the surge, which worked, it wasn't sustained. And the initial surge didn't have all of the operational impacts that it needed, lessons learned, to make sure that we were there in court and the prosecutions were maintained in a productive manner.
Frank, these kind of flood the zone tactics, what kinds of concerns do those raise for you? I'm going to ask you to put on your civil rights lawyer hat for a moment. What are the concerns? What are the red flags with this kind of policing?
Always disparate enforcement. When you look at these types of surges and who they target in the neighborhoods that they target, you're criminalizing poverty, and this disproportionately impacts folks who are racial minorities. And so the community is already somewhat at odds with law enforcement, and then you go in with these surges and you create a deeper chasm that we end up having to deal with later on, or it doesn't get dealt with at all. And so I think the disparate enforcement and the disparate impact on these racial minorities and these poor communities is just a travesty, and it's awful, and it's not something that we can say has ever worked or will ever work.
Is it overly presumptuous to say that this is, at least from some perspective, an open invitation for like a rolling Fourth Amendment violation?
Absolutely. That's what ends up happening here. Guys like me come in and we get to represent a lot of clients who have had their civil rights violated. And it's terrible. I wish we didn't have to go that route. But it is an open invitation for you to circumvent the normal channels of law enforcement that you would normally follow. And bringing in the feds, I don't know how that's going to help with a local problem, especially when we're talking about issues of poverty, issues of drug abuse, issues of mental health disorders. Bringing in the feds isn't going to help with that.
I don't want to put on too many hats. Really quick, Marisa, I want to get Tom in here on this. I'm going to ask you to go back to being a cop, as you were for a long time. And let's go back to the problem the governor says she wants to solve. These kinds of operations, we've had a long conversation here at the table now about getting a bunch of low-level folks, calling them the worst of the worst, whatever that is. But to get at the trigger pullers in town, the people who are responsible for the real illicit drug trade, the fentanyl, the gun trade, all of that, that takes a different kind of police work, doesn't it? Tell viewers a little bit, like, what does it take to get at that? How do you get at that?
It takes having a relationship with the community. It takes having a relationship and knowledge in the area that you're patrolling, whether it's just being familiar with folks or getting information from folks so you can pass it off to those people that do the investigations on those, you know, higher level criminal offenders. What's ironic about all this is that with the idea of having a surge, just as Frank said, you're going to have officers come in that have no attachment to the community, have no familiarity with the community, and they're tasked to enforce crime upon people that they don't have any relationship with. So you're instantly going to have this us versus them landscape. And, you know, 3 years ago when the country was going through the 2020 riots and the George Floyd-related protests, I mean, the people that are in office now were putting forward mailings that literally were demonizing the police. You've been pulled over. All you can do now is trust this ends well. And what's happening is we're going to have the exact type of circumstances infused into the city that aren't really productive to addressing crime. Sure, there may be an immediate reduction in some offenses in some areas where officers are infused, but is that good policing? Is that good law enforcement? And is that going to be a remedy for the crime that's happening in the city? And the significant crime that has triggered all this has been the increase in homicides and violent crime. I don't know.
And Marisa, it is happening. State police have to comply with this order. They announced yesterday that they're going to. And conversations are ongoing, according to Maine Justice, between the Lujan Grisham administration and DC.
Right. So the part of the order that the judge put the stay on is just that Second Amendment part. The rest of this is all still in play. And, you know, what happened with the first Metro surge, as they did a lot of reporting and looking for records and checking it out, was that there was, as far as I could tell, not a plan in place until after they were already deployed. There seemed to be some concern about communication between state police and APD, right? And then also with those 15,000 traffic stops that I think turned into something like 800 arrests, most of those cases were tossed in the end because of either no follow-up from officers or not a lot of prosecution or appetite from the DA's office at the time, but also for shaky cases, right? And for search and seizure violations, which is the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, right? So those Metro surges yielded historically those problems.
So I want to talk about one other thing that's been overlooked, I think, in some of the language. The governor's order also directs cities and counties to invoke the Riot Control Act to address what she's calling a state of emergency stemming from gun violence. We haven't seen support for any of her plans from leaders in the Albuquerque area, but Tom, what would using that old statute actually look like?
I have no idea. I mean, it's totally perplexing. You know, as I understand the implementation of her order, she's going to have essentially a crime czar overseeing the operations in the Albuquerque-Bernalillo area.
Pete Casetas.
As the director of crime reduction or something like that, which has its own backstory that I'm sure everyone that's familiar with former Chief Casetas knows about. But I mean, it's uncharted territory. And the notion that that order is supported by this analysis under the Emergency Health Powers Act, that there's this ongoing, continuing, emerging threat to everybody that unless certain actions are taken, I think is frankly ludicrous.
Let's talk about one other thing that's in that order that I don't think has gotten as much attention also. This might be a rhetorical question, by the way. The order also suspends the state's Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative and directs CYFD to evaluate juvenile probation protocols. We played a bite earlier in the show where the governor said, quote, the notion that there's no accountability must end. But this program applies almost exclusively to nonviolent youth crimes. I'll toss this out for anybody who wants to take a swing. How would locking up more children reduce gun violence in Albuquerque?
It's heart-wrenching to hear this type of rhetoric, especially coming from the governor. Arresting children doesn't help anyone. I think we saw with the Benny Hargrove Act that was recently passed that we are trying to curb some of the access and the ability of children to get guns and to harm other folks. And that's a more sensible approach. But saying that we shouldn't give kids another chance, give them all the chances. This is our opportunity to get through to them is when they're juveniles, because we know once they get into the system, they become adults, they become better criminals. They're not going to reform. So let's give them chances and let's try these alternatives while they're still kids.
Let's try for some gavel thoughts. We'll go around the table. We'll start with you, Marisa. If this whole thing was meant to be a conversation starter, well, everyone's talking now. But where does the conversation go now and how does it end?
I think it's pointing at the rebuttable presumptions in the legislative session. It was part of the news conference, something she tried in the last legislative session. And I think that's where we're headed.
And to remind viewers, that's sort of rolling back the reforms to the bail system that we had.
Right, yeah. Meaning that the onus would be on a person to prove that they're not violent when they're in court, as opposed to the state proving that they are, mm-hmm. right, to put it simply. And you know, the state is trying to change that standard, which was part of bail reform. And so I think that's where the conversation's going in January.
Tom, what's next?
I think there's gonna be a lot of strife going on between the parties and within the parties. And what's tragic is that this family's tragedy that had their son murdered is really the 11-year-old boy. And I was at that stadium 5 days before with my own 11-year-old boy. And it really breaks my heart that they're sort of being kicked around as a political football. And what we've seen is that public safety has turned into the ultimate political football between the parties. And from that, there's a distraction to doing what really needs to be done, which is provide avenues of relief so that people don't feel so desperate or lost and are resorting to crime. Provide some, you know, law enforcement measures that will curb crime without inflicting civil rights violations upon everybody, and move forward as a state instead of two parties. And I don't see that happening. I mean, we've got the governor and the attorney general throwing jabs at each other. So I think it's gonna get hotter politically. And unfortunately, us who live in Albuquerque and Bernalillo County are gonna suffer the consequences of that.
Frank, quickly, where do you see this going next?
Hopefully it's twofold. One is let's give the kids a chance. Let's rethink suspending the alternatives programs and allow the juveniles a chance at reform. Two, I hope that the governor continues to try and curb gun violence in the state, but I hope she does it in a sensible way. I hope she goes back to the drawing board and comes up with creative solutions that address the real issues that undergird the violence instead of just focusing on the symptoms.
Thank you for listening to the podcast this week. Be sure to follow our pages on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube throughout the week. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm senior producer Lou DeVizio for Tuesday, September 19th, 2023. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.